You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although most people in this country seem to be unaware of it, Canada, our neighbor to the north, is in the middle of what seems to be a major political crisis. With me now to explain is Adam Radwanski, a member of the Globe and Mail's editorial board. He also writes a political blog for that paper. Welcome back to our show.
Thanks very much.
Canada held elections on October 14th, just 2 months ago, and the governing Conservative Party, led by Prime Minister Stephen Harper, held on to its power. So how have we wound up in the situation that's been described variously as a political crisis and a constitutional crisis?
Well, it did retain its power, but as previously, it was held to a minority government, which means it has fewer than half the seats in the House of Commons. That means that at pretty much any time, it can be defeated by the opposition parties, of which there are three with significant power or any power in the House of Commons. The expectation was that none of the opposition parties would have any interest in bringing down the government anytime soon after the election.
Were they serving in coalition with the Conservatives?
They were not in coalition before. They basically they need one of the parties to vote with them on any given piece of legislation to survive, which is pretty much what happened in the first term for 2.5 years. They're neither in coalition with them nor against them.
Because the opposition couldn't get together and come up with a unified strategy?
Well, this is what happened, and eventually they wound up coming up with a unified strategy. But the opposition is of such different interests. There's the Liberal Party, which is sort of the centrist or center-left party. There's the New Democrats, which is sort of the Social Democratic Party. And then complicating matters is the Bloc Québécois, which is a Quebec sovereigntist party. So clearly their agenda is at odds with the other parties normally. And it would be seen as being politically disadvantageous for any of the other parties to strike a formal coalition with a party that basically has as its core objective to break up the country. So they've generally held off on coalition arrangements. What happened was when they returned in November, there was much talk of a new spirit of cooperation because the last session of Parliament was really, really contentious and quite vicious at times. The Prime Minister had made noises about seeking cooperation with the opposition to address the economic crisis. They seemed to have no interest in bringing down the government. The Liberal Party, which is the official opposition, was in the process of a leadership change, having run a terrible campaign and having a very weak leader in place. What happened, though, was that after all that talk of cooperation, the Conservatives returned in late November with an economic update, sort of a mini-budget to precede the one coming in the winter, in which they were expected to provide a stimulus package for the economy. Instead of that, they provided very little stimulus, but they did include a bunch of measures that were basically aimed at antagonizing the opposition, or at least had that effect. One of which, and this sounds incredibly minor, but was a reform to campaign finance rules or party finance rules that would have taken away public funding from political parties, which wouldn't hurt the Conservatives all that much because they have a lot of private fundraising, would have really crippled the Liberal Party and to a lesser extent, or the Bloc Québécois as well, and to a lesser extent than Democrats. Basically, he forced their hand, the Prime Minister forced their hand into forming some kind of coalition against him because what they would have been doing otherwise is signing on to basically their own death certificate, at least the next couple of elections.
Didn't he realize that?
Well, you would think he would have. I think what he was expecting was that they were too disorganized to form a united front and that he would have an easy time selling this particular change to the electorate, which he has to an extent. Because, you know, it always sounds good to take money away from political parties. Nobody really has a strong objection to that. But what he didn't count on, I think, and Mr. Harper is prone to overreaching. I mean, he's quite a sort of political animal and is always looking for the tactical advantage over his opponents. But he's prone to these sort of hyper-partisan moves that can backfire. And what I don't think he was counting on was that the opposition, despite the weak leadership that it had at the time, would be galvanized by this and would actually wind up forming the coalition. So what happened was that the Liberals, New Democrats, and Bloc Québécois came back pretty quickly with a plan to defeat the government and to replace it with a coalition amongst them. This started barreling forward, and then the Conservatives started backtracking from the measures they had introduced in their economic update. But by this point, once the ball started rolling, the opposition wasn't backing off. And I think with the realization that whenever he has an opportunity, the Prime Minister was going to try to put them out of commission or at least to severely hurt their interests, and on the pretext, and not illegitimately, that at a time of economic crisis, the government had not responded with an economic response, but a partisan response.
In your most recent blog, in the Globe and Mail political blog, you wrote that, I'm quoting, after the way he's behaved the past few weeks, anything Stephen Harper does is going to seem vaguely sinister.
Yeah.
So people are suspicious of his every move now.
Yeah, and this is a problem for him even before, in that he's got a real mean streak to him. The most unfavorable comparison that I've heard up here is people have called it almost a sort of Nixonian streak, which may be a little harsh. But he
against Nixon or Harper?
Well, I think in the context it's meant against Harper, because what's implied is that sort of paranoia that I think is I think has been a problem for him and has held him back, and he's prone to really lashing out. I mean, this is a guy who during their first term, was prone to suggesting that opposition MPs who were against or had concerns with the Afghanistan mission were supportive of the Taliban, or of suggesting that they're motivated by a Sikh MP's family connections to terrorism. So he really is prone to lashing out in a way that is quite unfavorable. And in this sense, I think it was the first time that it's really caught up to him. To the extent that it almost cost him government, and I think people really were woken up to the problem that his first reaction is more partisan than it is policy.
And he has pulled some kind of constitutional ploy, which we'll get to in a moment.
Yeah.
But I was curious about a recent survey I read about Canadians not really understanding their own political system. I always thought that Canadians were better informed than people in this country.
We like to think that we are. I think we may be better informed a little bit, I'd like to think, in a global sense. We certainly probably know more about American politics than Americans know.
But according to the poll, 51% of Canadians thought that the prime minister was elected directly. 41% didn't know that the country was a constitutional monarchy, and we'll get to that.
Yeah.
75% of Canadians thought that the prime minister or governor general was head of state when the queen actually is. I mean, these are things that even I knew.
It's a huge problem, and we're I think part of it is just the way that we teach it in schools, and part of it, frankly, is just a real disinterest in Canadian politics. And, you know, we saw that crop up this fall when elections in the U.S. and Canada were running concurrently. There was a lot more interest in the American election than there was in the Canadian election here. That's partly because of the personalities involved. But also there's been a general level of disinterest. And if there's an upside to what's gone on here recently, which I guess we'll get into a bit in terms of the constitutional issues, but if there's an upside to the political chaos we've had here in the last month or so, it's that at least people have started to be forced into paying a little closer attention to how things work. I can tell you that when we've been looking at the traffic on our website, which I'm sort of involved in bringing the political stuff on, there was actually more traffic on our site during this crisis than there was during the election. So I think people have started to wake up. You know, there have been words like prorogue, which refers to what Mr. Harper successfully achieved, which is basically to suspend Parliament effectively, that people were unfamiliar with before. There have been issues with, you know, can we form a coalition government? People thought, well, I didn't know this could happen. Well, you know, that's parliamentary democracy. So we are kind of waking up to that, which is probably healthy because we're heading into an era here in which the era of majority government seems to be over, at least for now. And when there's a majority government, I mean, the system is fairly straightforward. You know, whoever gets the most seats runs the country for 4 years, roughly, and then we elect a new government or re-elect them. With minorities, there's all kinds of deal-making. There's all sorts of potential for the sorts of constitutional issues that we run into. You need a more informed voter, given that your MP may have a specific decision to make about whether to support the government or not, and so on. So it's probably healthy that we've gotten woken up a little bit. On the downside, it's happened in the middle of an economic crisis when you would hope that that our government would actually be functioning and be addressing that as opposed to running a civics course for the country.
My guest is Adam Radwanski, a member of the Toronto Globe and Mail's editorial board, also writes a political blog for that newspaper. So let's do a brief review of the basics of Canadian politics. The Queen of England is really the country's sovereign,
yes.
Still.
Yes.
Unlike some other countries in the Commonwealth.
Yes, she is, but very, very, very rarely, in fact, never would be involved in actual decision-making regarding the country. I mean, her representative in Canada is the Governor General.
And he does play a major role. He did, at least in this crisis.
Yeah, Michel Jean is the Governor General, and she does play a role. And, of course, the tricky part of this is that that's been largely treated, and perhaps it shouldn't have been, and perhaps this will change that, been largely treated by prime ministers who recommend the Governor General appointments to the Queen, so basically choose them. That's been largely sort of a symbolic appointment that's been treated as such. So the current Governor General is a woman of the background in broadcasting, sort of from Quebec, sort of an arts background, you know, quite an appealing and you know, very presentable person, but doesn't have any political background, really, certainly not at this level. And suddenly she's entrusted with deciding whether to accept the prime minister's request to prorogue parliament, which basically means to shut it down and restart.
And
in
she
a very
said
unusual
yes.
Circumstance. She said yes, and it was a very unusual circumstance.
Has this ever been done before in Canadian history?
Well, proroguing happens quite often, but it would normally happen a couple of years into a mandate. It's sometimes a way to sort of get a fresh start, because all the legislation is basically wiped out and you start anew. So the government feels that it's sort of fulfilled an agenda in the first couple of years, or in a minority parliament, if it feels that it's reached a bit of an impasse, it can do that to try to restart. It's never been done basically at the start of a mandate. I mean, this is basically a do-over. They came back to Parliament. They did the speech on the throne, which is sort of the introductory agenda for the new session. They introduced the fiscal update. All the chaos began, and they shut it down. So we're basically going to have to start all over again in late January.
So let me ask you this. Stephen Harper really just put off the inevitable, which is another election. Because if he gets a vote of no confidence, he's going to have to call a new election. So what does he gain by holding off until January rather than just doing it now?
Two things. First off, it wasn't actually necessarily that there would be another election. The opposition party was actually trying to form a coalition government and overtake him. He might have gone to the Governor General and asked for an election if that had happened.
Mm-hmm.
But she would have had every right to ask the Liberal Party, with the support of the other two parties, to form government. Now, that being said, in terms of putting off the inevitable, that may not be the case. First of all, what Mr. Harper is going to do, we expect, although with him you can never be entirely certain, we expect that they're going to return in late January with a much different fiscal plan from what they presented now, one that would probably have a lot of economic stimulus, and in fact they're already dropping hints about that. That could make it a lot more difficult for the opposition parties to oppose, considering also that the measures they objected to have been removed. The other variable in this is that the Liberals have just undergone a leadership change. At the time when the coalition talks were going forward, they were led by Stéphane Dion, who had been a former minister in Liberal governments in the 1990s and earlier this decade, who had led them into the last election, performed quite poorly, seemed to be quite out of his element.
And promised to quit if he lost.
Well, and had, in fact, announced his resignation after the election to be effective in May, when they were to have a leadership convention and choose a new leader. Now it's gotten a little more a little more confusing, because what's happened is that they accelerated that process. He performed particularly badly, Mr. Dion did, in the midst of all of this. There was a sort of the what epitomized his leadership problems was an address to the nation that came right before the Governor General was asked to make her decision. Mr. Harper took to the airwaves, did a televised address that went, relatively smoothly, fairly straightforward. This sounds almost unbelievable. Mr. Dion's people submitted the tape late that they were supposed to be broadcasting nationally. It was filmed improperly, or it was transported improperly, so it was all out of focus and looked ridiculous. And that, I think, was sort of the final straw for his party. It's now accelerated the leadership process and replaced him with Michael Ignatieff, who I imagine some listeners might be familiar with.
As an American journalist and academic.
Well, Canadian technically, but it spent a lot of time in both the U.S. and in Britain. Academic, broadcaster, et cetera, much different type. He's now leading the Liberals, and he seemed to be less keen on the coalition arrangement. I'm not sure that he wants to go for a really unwieldy coalition with a fairly hard left party and a separatist party right after taking over his own party.
Well, we have to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about those different parties and what they represent. Mm-hmm. And Michael Ignatieff, who also supported the war in Iraq, which I imagine isn't getting all that much support from his own party.
Yeah.
Adam Radwanski is a member of the Toronto Globe and Mail's editorial board, who also writes a political blog for the newspaper. And we're talking about what I'm not sure can be called either a political or a constitutional crisis in Canada, even though it's getting very little attention in this country. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're talking about what's going on in Canada with Adam Radwanski, and there are two things I want to clear up before we continue. Adam, I've been saying the Toronto Globe and Mail, but it's called the Globe and Mail
these days. It is, yeah.
It's
a national paper. We are based out of Toronto, but it is a national paper.
It used to be the Toronto Globe and Mail.
Once upon a time, but it is a national paper. So there, we basically have a couple of national papers here. There's us and the National Post, and then some more locally based. The Toronto Star is a big Toronto paper.
Of course, it was the Toronto paper before there were political blogs, and now you write a political blog in this paper as well. And I'm not sure whether we should call this a political or a constitutional crisis.
It's a little bit of both. I'm not sure it quite fell into constitutional crisis mode. It came pretty close, and I think we might have been pointing to that had the Governor General ruled otherwise or had Mr. Harper challenged her in some way. I think a political crisis is probably a better definition of it still. I think it's certainly qualifies as that. I think constitutional crisis might be a little strong. I mean, it didn't wind up going to the courts or anything like that.
Can we take a quick look at the parties and see how we can relate to them? Are candidates is Canada's Conservative Party the equivalent of our Republican Party, or more like the British Conservative Party?
It's more like the British Conservatives. I mean, it's tricky to try and line them up too closely with either. I mean, Canadian politics are just a little bit further to the left to begin with than American politics are. So, in fact, if you actually look policy to policy, our Liberal Party is probably our Conservative Party is probably not that far off from the Democrats when you get down to it. But in the way that it's viewed up here, yeah, I mean, the closest analogy would be the Liberals are like the Democrats and the Conservatives are like the Republicans.
Liberals are not like the Labour Party in England. They're at least they don't have a socialist background. You have
they
a different
don't have
party
a
that
background.
Has that.
That's the Democrat Party, yeah. I mean, in terms of current policies, they're probably closest to Labour, but they don't have that background. Labour itself, as in the unions, remain tied to the New Democrats, although there's been some separation there, but the New Democrats, for instance, when they have a party convention, still have a certain number of delegates allocated to Labour and so on. So the NDP is the traditional party of the left. The Liberals are the traditional party of the center. The Conservatives are the traditional party of the right. And until the late 80s and early 90s, we had a fairly strict, you know, three-party system. It's gotten somewhat confused since that time. For one thing, there was a split on the right around that time. The old Progressive Conservative Party was basically supplanted more or less by the Reform Party, which was a more Western Canadian, more hardline Conservative Party. They basically were divided for about 10 years until there was a merger between the two, and they're now just the Conservative Party. The splitting is now happening actually more on the left. You know, if you add up the percentage of votes, I mean, the Liberals combined with the Democrats and also the Green Party, which doesn't have any seats but got about 6 or 7% of the vote in the election, they're all combined are you know, well over 50%, but they're really fragmented and you know, splitting the vote in individual constituencies.
And would the Bloc Québécois be called left or right?
They're on the left. Quebec is a fairly left of center province. So they're on the left, but of course their original agenda has been separation of province. It's gotten a little confused because they've become kind of institutionalized in Ottawa. I mean, they've now been there with seats for the better part of two decades. They've been at times the official opposition, and they're now talking about working with other parties in government. So they're basically, I suppose, less a separatist party than a nationalist party at this point. Their first and really only interest is what's best for Quebec, but that entails, an agenda that's heavy on social spending, quite resistant to military endeavors, that sort of thing.
So actually, in the, as a separatist party, they've been able to get a lot of concessions from the national government, and probably is in their best interest to remain in the national government. Is Canada broken up into red provinces and blue provinces, a la the U.S. red states and blue states?
Well, not exactly. There are places that are distinctly one or the other. For instance, the province of Alberta, which has Calgary and Edmonton, and is an oil-rich province, is almost uniformly conservative. I think they hold every seat in the province, save one. Ontario is seen as being a more liberal province, but there's more almost of an urban and rural divide, or urban and small town divide. The Liberal Party has increasingly been seen its base shrunk to a few urban centers. So they're dominant in Toronto. They have all but two seats out of 21 in the city of Toronto. They're strong in Vancouver. They're strong in Montreal. The Conservatives are much stronger in small-town Canada, in Western cities.
Well, this sounds like the United States to some degree.
It's not dissimilar. And the complicating factor is Quebec, where the Bloc Québécois have more than half the seats, and then the Liberals and Conservatives have been sort of fighting over the scraps for the last few years. So there is a real divide, and one of the challenges for the Liberal Party, and this is what Mr. Ignatieff has been talking about since he took over, and as have other Liberals, is to reconnect outside of those bases, because they've really become limited. I mean, they used to be very strong in Quebec. They were strong in much of rural Canada, not so much Western Canada, but still. And they've really seen that shrunk away as they've become a very urbanized party. So the challenge for them is to find ways that they can regain votes and regain support in small-town Canada, which is going to be an interesting challenge for them, given who their leader is. I mean, Mr. Ignatieff has quite a bit going for him. He's about as urban and sort of Toronto a person as you're going to get in Canadian politics. I mean, given his academic background and so on, he's not exactly the kind of guy who immediately connects with small towns. So it really is an interesting challenge for them in the months or years ahead.
I'm talking with Adam Radwanski, a member of Canada's Globe and Mail's editorial board. He also writes a political blog for the newspaper. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, Michael Ignatieff, as I said, was initially a supporter of the war in Iraq. Would mm-hmm. that hurt him with the Liberal Party membership?
It has somewhat. It's been used against him quite a bit. In fact, he ran for leader 2 years ago, or 2.5 years ago, when Mr. Dion was elected leader. He was actually the leader on the first ballot and then wound up getting defeated subsequently. So, yeah, there was that was used against him quite a bit. Likewise, his positions on torture, which has been he has a fairly nuanced position on it, but it's been something that they can use against him. He's generally seen as being maybe a little bit more conservative than the party has been, which is problematic possibly in this coalition arrangement, and certainly raised some concern with party members. The interesting thing is that he's actually in Quebec, which is the most anti-war province in the country. He's actually quite strong because he's also seen to be more open to recognizing Quebec nationalism than some other liberals are. So he's managed to overcome that handicap to a large extent, but it's something that we'll still see used against him. Of course, if the Conservatives use it against him in campaign ads and so on, it'll be difficult since they also supported the war in Iraq and much more strongly than even he did.
Other than Stephen Harper's heavy-handed approach, mm-hmm. would this political crisis have occurred if there weren't a global financial crisis?
No, I don't think it probably would have. I don't think they would have had the pretext with which to try to overthrow the government. I mean, had he done this under different circumstances, it would have been awfully difficult for the opposition to say they were doing it for the better interest of the country. I think their reaction, and I think it was legitimate in part, but I think also they had to frame it this way, was that at a time of crisis, we can't have a prime minister who's more focused on partisan ends than on the best policy interests of the country.
So what are the problems right now? How badly has Canada's economy been hit?
The funny thing is it hasn't been hit that badly yet.
Canada has a lot of car plants, doesn't it?
It does, and that's particularly a problem in Ontario. I mean, when I say it hasn't been that badly hit, the last available numbers aren't that bad, but I think there may just be something of a lag. There's been a lot of debate about whether we're in recession or not in recession. I mean, for all intents and purposes, I think we're either in one or headed into one. the auto industry has been hit particularly hard, and that's heavily centralized in Ontario, which is the largest province and closest to your listeners. You know, in southern Ontario, particularly in Windsor, which is right by Detroit, you know, the city of Oshawa, there's entire towns that are basically at risk, much like some cities in Michigan are, of just their economy completely drying up in the absence of the auto industry. There's also concerns with forestry, with mining. So there are certainly very strong concerns about job losses. It's just been a little bit confusing in terms of where exactly we're at, because the government on the one hand has been able to say, we're not in recession yet, look at all these strong measures we took last term, this is why we're not. But at the same time, everybody's aware that's where we're headed. And so during the campaign, the government certainly didn't want to admit that there was any urgency to this at all. And now it's sort of plunged into bailout mode. So suddenly we're talking about billions of dollars to the auto industry. And now we have a story today that suggests that there's billions of dollars coming to forestry and mining. So certainly there is a lot of concern here, but nobody is quite sure just how severe it is.
Well, our whole problem began with a housing crisis.
Yes.
When the mortgage sector really fell apart. And not a problem in Canada?
No, that didn't happen the same way here. Our banks are quite a bit stronger. In fact, internationally, they've proven to be surprisingly strong compared to almost every other Western country. They've been pretty strong. So we didn't have the same kind of crisis here with that. It's more been, I think, largely the fallout from the global effects. I mean, I think from the U.S. in particular, of course, as still a large trading partner for us.
What about the strength of the Canadian dollar? At one point, it actually became more valuable than the U.S. dollar after many years of being a real bargain for Americans.
Yeah, and it's actually having gone back down now somewhat. That's actually not unhelpful from our perspective, from the perspective of industry, because I think it's fair to say, and there was some criticism when the dollar actually went up here, or some at least looking back and reflecting, that we hadn't necessarily done enough to strengthen our industry, that we had basically gotten lazy counting on the low dollar to make investment attractive, and when the dollar went way up, it was actually jeopardizing some of our industries. So that may actually be moderately helpful to our interests. Not so good from other perspectives, but may actually cushion a little bit what the blows could be to industry.
Have the various competing political parties come up with proposals to deal with this economic crisis?
Well, that's the funny thing, is we've been having all of this fallout in the middle of an economic crisis, and yet the actual specifics have been fairly limited.
No bailouts proposed?
Well, there are the bailouts that the Conservatives are now floating and seem to be moving toward in their January budget. For the auto industry, I think $3 or $4 billion, $3.2 billion, I think Canadian is what's being talked about for the auto industry right away. Forestry and mining now is coming up as well. That wasn't in the update at all. And the Liberals and the Democrats and Bloc Québécois were their position was that there should be a stimulus package. There should be investment in these industries. I think they want further investment in training and that sort of thing. But they didn't lay out any actual specifics. In fairness, there's the argument that without having had access to the books, it's awfully hard to come up with a very specific package of what you're going to fund. At the same time, I think that may have actually hurt them in the sort of public relations war about whether this coalition government should take over, was that they never really put out a firm plan of what exactly it was that they wanted to do, which you would think, if you're complaining the government's not doing enough, would probably be a helpful thing to put forward.
You said that Michael Ignatieff's debut press conference was made for rather good theater as well. What did he do?
Well,
after the debacle of Dion's press
conference. Yeah, he's an interesting public performer. He certainly doesn't stick the script very rigidly, and he's prone to sort of these rambling, vaguely poetic responses where, for instance, he was asked about rural Canada, and suddenly he was talking about growing up in barns, which I found a little bit questionable, but sort of waxing poetic about the western skies and all this sort of thing. But what was interesting in terms of the sort of drama of it was that he was much more, he took a much harder line toward the Prime Minister. I mean, Mr. Dion before him had a sort of constantly exasperated and sort of vaguely whiny kind of tone toward the government, and it's alleged, partisan, hyper-partisanship and so on. Mr. Ignatieff was much more seemed a lot stronger in responding to it. He effectively challenged the prime minister to put out attack ads against him, which they did to the previous leader in the middle of the crisis, saying Canadians would judge our government very harshly. They did that right now. He more or less warned him that he was fully prepared to bring down the government if he had to in late January. The whole thing was just done with a much different tone. Had an edge to it that I think has been badly lacking for the opposition parties here.
But you also suggested earlier that he's in a bind because he really doesn't want to ally himself with the parties that are further to his left, and he would have to if he were to put together a coalition government. On the other hand, he obviously cannot really enter into any agreement with the Conservative Party.
There'd be no agreement with the Conservatives. The question is whether they bring them down or not. What he's basically doing is keeping the coalition in his back pocket. He gave an interview a while ago where he said, coalition if necessary, not necessarily coalition. I think that's pretty much sums up what his approach is. If he wants to make sure that he has it as a hammer there, if the Conservatives bring in another budget that the Liberals don't feel they can support, they don't want to get caught in the bind they did last session, which was where they didn't feel like they were ready to head into an election. So they just kept supporting the government or abstaining from votes, which was seen as being really weak and basically propping up a government that they were supposedly opposed to. So he wants to make sure he's got that possibility. But I don't think he wants to overcommit, as some other Liberals wanted to do, including the previous leader, and say, well, we're plunging forward with the coalition no matter what.
Just one more thing. It's really important that the United States maintain real stability for Canadians. What about the other way around? Would it matter to us if there were a serious crisis in Canada?
I would think that it might. I don't think it would matter greatly. I think it would certainly hurt us a lot more than it would hurt the U.S. I would imagine on a couple of areas. You want to know who you're dealing with, for instance, on the auto sector, which clearly the incoming president is having to devote a lot of attention to. You want to work hand in hand with a country that shares the North American industry to advance its goals. It's hard to do that if you don't know who's leading it. But I think it's fair to say that our interests are much, much, much more at stake right now. Our problem is that we may not have a leader who's able to go forward with the confidence of our parliament to deal with foreign leaders. It makes it a lot more difficult. You don't have that kind of legitimacy. If there's an international summit, say, in January on any kind of issue, our prime minister is going to go, but it's not really clear whether he's our prime minister or he's just on a sort of stay of execution. So it's really inopportune for us. From a U.S. perspective, I don't think it has a huge impact other than, as I said, on issues like bailout for the auto industry and other sectors. It could even be forestry or other sectors like that. It would probably be easier to know how Canada is moving forward.
Adam Radwanski is a member of the Globe and Mail's editorial board and writes a political blog for the newspaper. Thank you so much for clearing up so much. I think I know more about Canadian politics right now than most Canadians.
That's probably a fair bet.
Thanks again.
Thanks. Take care.